Again, can we go through formal introductions, just everyone saying their name for the record?
Tom Krebs, Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
John Armstrong, ARMSTRONG.
Bob Binkley, HANKLAY.
Mina Simhai, MINASIMHAI, Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
Brad Bondi, BONDI, at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
Steve Cohen, Clayton Holdings.
Vicki Beal, Clayton Holdings.
Mark Rothenberg, Blank Rome, on behalf of Clayton Holdings and Vicki Beal.
Today's date is July 22nd, 2010. Ms. Beal, we are representatives of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and we appreciate very much you coming up and talking to us. It's going to be hopefully a very informative session we have here to set out today. By way of background, the FCIC was established by Congress for the purpose of reporting to the President of the United States and the people of the United States what were the causes of the financial crisis. And to that end, we're looking at due diligence and securitization as part of that process. Not that that was part necessarily of the crisis, but in order to get a complete picture of that market and what's going on. Now, for purposes of this interview, we will be taping. Do you consent to our taping this interview?
Yes.
Thank you, ma'am. I'm also required to advise you that as officers of the federal government under 18 U.S.C. Section 1001, we are officers, and that it's a crime to tell us anything that's not true. And I'm certain you would not do that, but I'm required to tell you that. In connection with our inquiry today, it's going to be relatively informal. But if you have any question you don't understand, or you all want to go off the record and you want to take a break, just let me know and we'll do that straight away. No problem. Do you understand that?
Yes.
Okay. We'll start with your name and position, and give us a little bit about your background, Ms. Beal.
Okay. I'm Vicki Beal, and I'm currently a Senior Vice President at Clayton in our Transaction Management Business Unit. And I started in the mortgage industry in around 1974 at First Federal Savings and Loan Association of Beaumont, Texas. And I was with them for around 18 years. And we went into receivership with the RTC in 1992. And at that time, and my duties there were varied. We weren't a very large savings and loan, so we, you know, did a lot of jobs, wore a lot of hats. And I did everything from in the loan servicing area and then handled our REO, real estate owned, and worked with our board of directors on setting reserves and worked with our commercial and acquisition, land loans, things like that to developers toward the end. And then I also was the liaison for our board of directors with the OTS, the Office of Thrift Supervision, as we were going into receivership. And once we were in receivership, I contracted with Coopers and Librand, who was the resolution assistance contractor. And I went to Houston and worked at the Gulf Coast Regional Office for several months, working on loan sales for the RTC and also continuing to service loans from the Gulf Coast Regional Office. And I got into the world of contracting that way, met people that were doing contract work for due diligence firms as people were buying loans from the RTC. And so I started working with Clayton in 1993. And my work with Clayton, I started as an underwriter. And at that time, it wasn't as much underwriting as it was data scrubs, kind of building a system, our Clayton Loan Analysis System class, so that we could input data to tell purchasers of loan pools from the RTC what they had purchased. And I did that, and then I became a project lead, a QCer, and then a project lead. And then so in that role, I actually was, going to sites in the field and reviewing loans and doing, managing transactions for Clayton on behalf of our clients. And in 2003, Clayton asked me to become an employee, and I went to the Shelton, Connecticut office as a client service manager managing some various clients. My clients included Lehman Brothers, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs. And then from there, I've been had various positions since that time at Clayton, including client service manager, team leader. I was in the product, headed up our product development group, and most recently deal and operations system support, the liaison between the business and our IT department in our systems. And then now I'm just a senior vice president of transaction management, working with our clients on deals that they need done.
When you began working as an underwriter with Clayton back in 1993, you were actually a contract person. You were not an employee of Clayton, is that correct?
That's correct.
And when you were with QC and you were moving your way up to become project lead, you were not an employee, is that correct?
That's correct.
How did Clayton go about acquiring your services back in 1993?
In 1993, the way I was hired is I knew someone that was working at Clayton in the Houston office. She had previously worked at the savings and loan I worked at. She was a loan officer, and she contacted me and wondered if I would want to do this.
While you were acting as an underwriter, did you travel across the country a good deal?
Yes, I did.
Would you go typically to the situs of the originator of loans and review their data there?
Yes, sir.
What data would you review in connection? Were you performing due diligence type reviews at that time?
Yes, sir.
Tell me about that process.
That process included, as I mentioned, we have a due diligence platform system, and it's a computer system. And we would take our laptops. In the early days, they weren't laptops. We had the big screens, the CRT screens and keyboards, and Clayton would ship those to the site, and we would set them up in a LAN network, a localized area network. We had a server and then our laptops, and then we had the loan files. And as an underwriter or a QC-er, you would, but an underwriter is a good way to show you because they're the beginning of it. We would get, our client service management team would that worked with the clients would get a tape, a data tape, and we would crack that tape and put specific data points into that class system, that's CLAS system. And then our work would begin. We would set up the systems, and we would sit down and crack a loan file. And as we would start to go through the loan documents, the note, the mortgage, the title, all the borrower's credit file, we would input data into our system. And then, so two things were going on. You were doing a data comparison on the data from the tape to what was actually in the loan file. And then we would typically get a set of guidelines from the seller. And it could be the seller plus our client may overlay the guidelines with some of their specific thresholds. And we would start to determine whether this loan that we were reviewing met the guidelines. And if it didn't, we would get exceptions, and we would make comments on those exceptions and grade the loans as to whether there were no exceptions, there were exceptions with compensating factors, or there was material risk or violation to the guidelines.
These were ranked 1, 2, and 3?
1, 2, and 3.
And there were two parts to it, weren't there? There was the compliance section, and then there was the credit section?
Yes.
Tell us about both those parts, please.
Okay, the two scopes, the credit and the compliance. The credit, and clients could choose, and we did some pools. We would do maybe 100% of our review might be compliance, and only a portion would be credit and compliance. Sometimes they did more compliance. So our system could handle either doing both scopes on all the loans or either or, both scopes. And for the credit, what we were looking for the necessary documents. We were looking at the credit report, the loan application. I guess a good way to put it is we were looking for the borrowers. It's just the old 3 C's of underwriting. We were looking for their capacity to pay, their character, their willingness to pay, and we were looking at the collateral. We were looking at the property. We would do, a review of the appraisal that was in the loan file.
Go ahead.
And the compliance piece was we were using the necessary documents. Clayton's compliance system is totally rules-based, so the underwriter
inputs. I'm sorry, the word is what?
Rules-based. In other words, it's it's all built in. All the logic is built in so that if I put in the date of a loan, the state, the city, the zip code, the purpose, the occupancy.
They would presumably tell you what
yes,
the compliance
system,
portion requirements
yes,
were with
system,
respect to that based
yes,
on that, that
yes.
origin of the loan.
Yes, our system had all those rules built in, so that was the compliance portion.
What kind of schooling did you and underwriters at Clayton have prior to assuming your duties as an underwriter?
Well, I had a lot of background in the industry, and but as we went on and I got more familiar with Clayton, we had very and went to work in Shelton. We had recruiting, we had a process around recruiting, hiring, training, and performance management. We had people that were responsible for that. That wasn't one of my duties, but they had that in place.
Presumably an underwriter is recruited by Clayton. You had to do something to determine whether or not that person could understand or could carry out their duties. What did you do?
Now, I'm going to tell you what I know.
That's
of
fine.
Working.
That's all.
I didn't work in that area, but this is what I know from working with the people that did or, being involved in presentations and things. Our underwriters typically had 3 to 5, were required to have 3 to 5 years experience as underwriters, processors, in the mortgage industry. They then were given a test over the phone, and then there would be if they passed that test, there was a secondary test which I was involved with from time to time as a client service manager, where we would then get the people on the phone and ask them questions and talk to them and get their feedback on situations and in loan files, just to size up their knowledge. And then they would be given a written test. And then we had, if they were hired, they had background checks and things, and then they were hired, and then we had ongoing training. We had some training courses that they would take ongoing.
Typically, how long those courses last?
It depended. We had compliance courses. Their training course when they came on, let me back up, they had a 2-week training when they were hired. And 1 week of it was strictly taking their underwriting skills and understanding what we did, what our role in the underwriting and due diligence process was,
mm-hmm.
and how to use our system. And the second week was using what they learned in that week and then testing them, doing some testing on their ability to go through a loan file, input the data into the system, come to the conclusions, that kind of thing.
When you interviewed people by telephone and asked them questions, was it done by script?
I believe that the people in our HR department that were doing the hiring or our recruiting department, I think they did have a script. I have not seen it, but I think they did. Now, when I would get on the phone with them, I would rather just ask them, questions that I thought I would know that they knew how to underwrite.
Okay. I mean, you'd ask them questions relative to the trade based on
yes,
your experience
yes.
to determine whether or not they actually
yes.
knew what they were saying, talking
exactly,
to you.
Exactly. So that they couldn't have maybe just looked at something and know the answers, or, it wasn't just answers or multiple choice. It was like, what would you do if, you saw this?
How did a person become a QC officer then, or a QC? Presumably that was a promotion.
Yes. When you were a QC-er, and we also had some QC training, because to be a QC-er, we would rely on a lot of feedback from our project leads, because they were the ones that were working closely with the underwriters and the QC teams. And in back in a lot of the time frame when we were very busy, we did mostly road deals. Since then, we have our Tampa centralized underwriting. But then when you had people just out on the road, the lead was the person that knew all the people that were working with them. So we would use a lot of feedback from the leads back to client service managers and our recruiting and training staff. And then we would look at the quality of their work, and then they would be brought into Shelton for training, and we would have a 1-week QC training, because even though you could underwrite and you could input data into the system, it was a level up, because you needed to start to understand how at the loan level and the overall pool level, how to summarize that data, how to use the data to look at things like tape discrepancy reports, where we would start to see fields, for instance, original loan amount, and that it was different. And we had query type tools in our system to be able to run reports and run specific reports, so we would train them on that. They learned how to go into a loan and look at the key data fields, the key documents, read the commentary. You know, it was a QC of the work of the underwriters, so it was more than just the underwriting. So we wanted to be sure they understood that and how to do the whole thing. And so we bring them in for training, and then they would be a QC-er. That didn't mean they would QC on every deal. They could go back to being an underwriter. It depended the way we staffed on, you know, capacity and who was available at that week. So, but it meant that they had the, you know, the capability of being a QC-er.
Did you also recruit your lead supervisors the same way you recruited your QC?
Yes.
That is, the QC-ers ultimately progressed up to be leads.
That was typically the way it was.
Tell me how leads conducted a particular due diligence review.
Leads were critical to the process because they were the, you know, the people on the ground at the front lines. They were working when we were out in the field. They, you know, got the equipment. They got the underwriters together at the hotel before they went to the job site. They were truly the manager of the project. And, you know, from soup to nuts, they were the ones that were keeping up with timesheets. They were working with the seller at the site to be sure we had file flow, that we were set up in the room, that the equipment got set up, and then they were, you know, instructing the rest of the team on, you know, they would show them here are the guidelines we're using. They would point out any specifics that we might have gotten as a client service manager passed down to the lead. From the client, anything specific they might want us to look at or any commentary they might want made. And then they were doing daily reports. They were doing backups of our system to be sure we had the data back in Shelton. So they were the ones that were running the whole project on the ground for us.
In 1993, I imagine the was a different world than it was in 2006.
Yes, sir.
How did that change over time?
Well, over time, and I'll just speak to my, you know,
sure,
what I saw in my roles.
Yeah.
In 1993, it was, as I said, it was more about the data and what had someone purchased, what had someone like a, I did a lot of work personally for Bank United in Houston, and they had purchased big pools of loans from the RTC. So they wanted to know, we would look at the loan files, what do I have? Are they fixed rate loans? Are they adjustable?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would look at, things like when's the maturity date. So they would get all this data. It was mainly data at that time. You know, where are the loans located? What's the remaining term? That kind of thing. As my work with Clayton evolved, I went through doing work for bank mergers like Fleet NatWest, Bank Boston, and Fleet, and then to Fleet NatWest.
You would go in and actually look at their portfolio of mortgages and
yes.
determine what, you know.
Yes, and there again, you know, a lot of it was about the data. A lot of it was what would I have? So the data was very important. But then I'll kind of give you the evolution of my work with Clayton. As we worked on the Fleet NatWest, we started to do some transfers to Freddie Mac of those loans. So we weren't actually doing the transfers. We were just working with Fleet on them to see what they could transfer of those loans. What would Freddie take? And that's where we came up with our 1-2-3 grading, because never before had we graded loans. So we wanted a way to be able to say a 1 at that point was this loan can be sold to Freddie Mac. A 2 was this loan could be sold to Freddie Mac, but I'm missing a document. There's something I could get that would make it okay to sell. And a 3 is it doesn't fit the guidelines. So that was the kind of the evolution of going from just looking at data and reporting on data to actually grading loans.
So you saw Freddie Mac's guidelines in 1993.
Yes, and I had worked with Freddie Mac also at the savings and loan. We delivered to Freddie and Fannie
So you were familiar with their underwriting requirements?
Yes.
I mean, their requirements with respect to loans. You knew which loans would be acceptable and probably those that would not.
Yes, yes. I knew the, you know, what the loan limits were, what the property types were that were acceptable. They had a lot of rules around condominiums. Had the projects had to be approved. They had a lot on planned unit developments, a lot of specific requirements. So, yes, I
was familiar with that. Those rules changed from Freddie Mac over time, didn't they?
You know, I think if you were delivering loans to Freddie Mac, yeah, I know their guidelines change, yes.
Yeah. Do you think they changed for the better? Did they lose quality or did they move with the market? Can you describe how Freddie Mac's rules changed?
You know, that's what I was just going to say earlier. I didn't in the later years work as closely on the delivery of loans to Freddie Mac. When we did work with Freddie Mac as a client of Clayton's, they were looking at subprime loans at that time. Our role kind of changed. So it wasn't about the delivery of their standard loans to them. So I really am not as up on the current guidelines for Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae.
Well, if they were buying loans in 1993, I suspect that they were, and they later went to subprime, I suspect that their underwriting requirements deteriorated, or at least were not as strong as they were in 1993. Because they were looking for different products. Is that fair?
Yes, when they were looking for different products. So my point is, I'm not sure that they changed on the delivery of their prime product, but I know when we were doing the subprime reviews for Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, we were typically using the seller guidelines of subprime shops. So in that respect, I would say the two.
Let me go back to that. I'm not sure I really understand the seller guidelines for subprime shops. Did they vary? I mean, you've got one shop over here, say Country Wide, one shop over here like Long Beach, one over here somebody else. Mm-hmm. Well, could you match them up, and did they all look the same, or were they quite different?
They were similar in that they told you the high levels were the same. They told you what were their property type requirements, their debt to income requirements, their loan to value and combined loan to value requirements. Asset and credit, but when you got into really reading them, they could be very different. So, we couldn't go from one shop to the other as we were doing reviews in the field and use the same set of guidelines.
So you could presumably look at the same loan pool for different folks and you might come up with entirely different answers.
Yes, that's true, because our clients then often, even if we went to the same shop, let's say we went to Ames for Lehman, Bear, Goldman, and Deutsche Bank, each of our clients may have some different requirements also, and they may have had different, we call them bid stips, that they would use to kind of overlay the guidelines. So you would have the guidelines, and then you may have like a subset of those guidelines.
I want to be certain that I understand what a bid stip is or an overlay is. We've been talking to some of the securitizing firms or the firms that securitize, and they have used the word overlay. Tell me what the relationship between an overlay is with respect to a guideline sent out for bid by an originator.
Okay. A guideline, as we were looking at them as underwriters, were their published set of guidelines that said, for this product, these are our requirements, these are the parameters. It has to be a certain credit score, a certain LTV, CLTV maximum, certain property type, certain occupancy for a certain program, and those were in their guidelines, and they would have many programs in the guidelines. But we would have a set of guidelines. And what we would get from our clients, they would say, you're going to use this set of guidelines.
And the client here would be the person who was going to buy those loans?
That contacted Clayton to do the review for them, yes. And we would assume that they were going to buy
the loans.
Typically
it was the person who was buying the loans,
yes.
Or underwriting the loans or whatever.
Yes, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And so let's just say that it was Deutsche that we were working with. I'm just going to throw out names. We would use...
Who we talked to, by the way.
Okay.
And it's a stay with Deutsche.
Okay. And so let's say we were going to option one, and we had option one's guidelines, and they would let you know, because guidelines would change over time, so you wanted to be sure you were underwriting to that set of guidelines that the client wanted, in other words, the date of the guidelines. So we would have a specific set of guidelines from option one. Then Deutsche Bank would also get with our client service manager at Clayton, who would then get this information to our lead and get it to the team in the field that would say, even though you're going to underwrite to these guidelines, we're going to say that they may allow credit scores of 550. We want you to flag any loans for us or grade any loans for us as a credit event 3 if the credit score is less than 575. They may even say, you know, that they were going to change it to that. They might have certain, and that would be the credit overlay. And then as compared to the bid stips, that may be something they negotiated with the client, with the option one at the time. They may say that, you know, your guidelines say that you can make manufactured homes, but we're not going to purchase any manufactured homes from you on this trade. So we would have, we could possibly have, you know, double sets of guidelines, I guess would be a good way to look at it. We would have the originator guidelines and any specifics our clients would tell us.
Conversely, if a bid came out and said our FICO score, minimum FICO score is 650, would you often get an overlay that says we will accept those at 640?
No, I never saw any that went less.
So they never went less?
No, it was any clients I worked with, it would be almost like a raising the bar.
Is the difference between a bid stip and an overlay? A bid stip is sort of a hard and fast rule. It becomes a 3. If it's below this, it gets kicked out. Whereas an overlay is we want to look at the file more closely for compensating factors and that sort of thing?
Yes, that's a good way to put it. Very good. And the bid stip, the way I understood it and with the clients I worked with, if that was understood between our client and the person that we're buying the loans from.
Right.
So that had been kind of negotiated between them. Yes.
Yeah.
And
describe for me a bid. I mean, tell me what it had. I mean, how did it work? Presume for the purposes of this example that I'm Deutsche Bank,
mm-hmm.
and you are the originator. You would presumably contact me and say, I've got these for sale.
You know, I really was never involved in that side of it to really be able to tell you how that worked.
But do you know whether or not that the offer for the sale contained a description with tolerances for the loans that were available for purchase?
You know, I only knew when it started with us.
Okay.
So I would hate to say, you know.
Well, let's go to that. You had the lead supervisors, and like, for example, Deb Medina and Gary Barmore. They were either liked by some people or disliked by others. For example, Gary Barmore was a favorite of Bank of America, and he was well-liked at Deutsche Bank. How is it that they were able to come in and say, I want Gary Barmore for this? Is it?
It was typically that we would have staffed Gary Barmore to one of their deals, one or more of their deals. And at, say, Bank of America, the transaction manager that we worked with oftentimes would also be on site, or someone, you know, that represented Bank of America. So it could have been that, or it was, I think, when they asked us for specific leads, that they felt like they did a good job for them, they were comfortable with them. The lead had to interact with both our clients and the sellers and the then our whole teams that were working. So they, you know, they really were pulled in a lot of directions. And leads that could handle, you know, kind of being pulled in a lot of directions, people would get comfortable with them. And that was the way I saw it. And, I mean, I was a lead, and I was requested to be a lead for several clients, you know, because I think you just proved yourself, and you did a good job for them.
Perhaps it's because they thought that you were comfortable with their standards, with what they were looking
for? Yes, yes, that was a lot of it, too. Maybe if you were a preferred lead, was what we called them sometimes, because we kept lists because our clients, you know, would ask for certain leads. It may be that you did more of their deals, you understood things like their credit overlays, you know, their thresholds and tolerances that they put on, specific fields in those overlays, and worked well, you know, with the transaction management teams. And maybe you went to the same originators because, as I said, we were looking at sets of guidelines, you know, week after week after week. You may be going to a different originator. And so if you were maybe worked New Century deals 2 weeks out of the month, you would be more familiar with New Century guidelines.
We have copies of documents that you have sent out to the various attorneys general's offices, and this is a preferred lead list, I believe. Is that correct? Can you identify that?
Yes.
Thanks. At the actual due diligence review, we had the...
Tom, if I may interrupt, one of you identify that so the tape recorder figures out what that is. If
unfortunately, this does not have a base number on it, as most of their documents did have. And I note that the document does say it contains confidential information and may not be copied or distributed without the express written consent of Clayton, and we'll treat that typically as we do with confidential documents here at the commission. But I'm going to go ahead and put a big number one on it as a exhibit number one to this statement. I'll give it to John.
And I would just add that Clayton was requested by the New York Attorney General to provide a list of preferred leads, and we provide a list of preferred leads, and that document appeared to be the one that we provided to New York.
Thank you. At the actual due diligence, I've got the underwriters, mm-hmm. I've got the QC people, I've got the lead. I've got a representative from the buyer?
Sometimes. That wasn't always the case.
Was there a representative from the seller or the originator there as well?
Yes. When we would go out, again, I'll use option one just
sure.
as a name. We would go to option one. They had a team of people that were like kind of like their logistics people that worked with the due diligence firms that came in. In other words, they had rooms we would go to. They knew the setup we needed. We got security badges from them, and they would typically be there if we, you know, during any of the hours we worked. And then there was a lot of interaction with that person, yes.
Well, what was the interaction? Was it discussions about particular loans about which there may be a question that's been raised by an underwriter through a QC person to the lead? Is that what would be discussed?
The interaction between the lead and the originator's contact would be around, as I mentioned, access to the building, you know, things like parking, that kind of thing, which you don't think much of until you have to actually go out and, you know, be on site. And then it would be about file flow was very important. That was a big thing because we had people there and we wanted to keep the files, you know, coming from, you know, wherever they were pulling them from. We wanted to be sure we had, at that time, they would bring them in boxes, and we wanted to have enough boxes of files to work on that day. We would keep up with missing files so that they were bringing them in any particular order. We would let them know which ones we didn't get. So that was some of the contact. But then the most important contact, to your point, was that when we were reviewing the loans, we would then come to a conclusion, grade the loans, and then out of our system we would create a report called an individual asset summary. And that was a bit important report because after the loan was underwritten, QC'd, and then typically reviewed by the lead, it would go to the seller representative if that was the instructions from our client. Sometimes our client might want to look at the loans first, but at some point the loans typically went back to that seller representative, who then had teams of people that were looking at any exceptions on our individual asset summary for missing documents, for any type of a rebuttal if we felt the value wasn't supported, and we wrote it up for that. Any conclusion we had on the grading of loans, they would review. And then in many cases, they would, you know, the lead would take their response and input that into our system, and then the clients would look at that.
Just so we really get a base of uh-huh. the data. Let's suppose there is a particular loan here, a loan file. What typically would be found within that loan file?
Okay, within that loan file.
And this is one that an underwriter is reviewing for purposes of determining whether it matches the guidelines that have been bid,
yes.
together with any additional overlays.
Yes. The loan file would typically contain legal documents specific to that transaction, the note, the mortgage, the title. Were very important, the HUD-1 settlement statement. So we would go through and we would input data from those documents. That was big. Then on the credit side, so that was kind of the legal doc side, was a piece. And then from the credit side, we would review the application. The file should have an application, a borrower's application. It would have a credit report. It would have any income and employment verification. It would have any asset verification that was required, if any was required. I'm trying to go down the list in my head. And then you would have on the appraisal. So as we were looking at the collateral, you would have the appraisal. We would review that. And then for compliance, you had a big document, you know, was the HUD one. And then we also used the note, again, for compliance, very important information on the note. And then also you had any of your compliance documents that were required by that transaction.
That particular state.
Yes, so your state or your type of transaction, if it was a refinance, you had your right of rescission, you had your final truth in lending, you had any pre-documents like your good faith estimates and that kind of thing. So those are off the top of my head the key documents.
Presumably there were some differences in a particular loan file, given that one might be a stated income loan, one might be a regular fixed rate mortgage loan, another one might be one with an adjustable rate. Is that right?
That's correct.
And those would all be noted within where? Within the form itself?
They would be noted in our due diligence platform, the class system that I mentioned. So you mentioned adjustable rates or fixed rates. When we go into our system and our underwriter opens the loan file and pulls the note, the note's one of the first documents we start with, by the way, because it sets the stage for whether it's fixed or ARM. You start to get your loan terms, your maturity, your interest rate, your principal balance, original principal balance, your payment amount. So we input all those data fields into our system. And what happens is if we say it's a fixed rate loan, the ARM fields don't open. If we say it's an adjustable rate, then we get ARM fields that open. So we start to input what kind of an ARM, when's the first rate change, the first payment change, the next rate change, the next payment change, the index, the margin. We start to capture all the characteristics of that specific type of loan.
What types of reports were generated by Clayton for a client, typically? And then I would like to ask if there are any unique or unusual circumstances, but what types of reports were generated by Clayton in connection with a due diligence review?
Okay. We typically reported daily to our clients, and not always, but I'm just going to do a typical due diligence review.
Sure.
We reported daily. They wanted to know our production, so our loan status, so that they could see, let's say we were reviewing 100 loans. They wanted to see on Monday how many loans we had underwritten, how many loans we had QC'd, and then the grades of those loans. So we had that production report. We had our individual asset summaries that I mentioned. So loan by loan, they would get a printout of the individual asset summary that gave the pertinent data by loan for the loan, and then the overall conclusion and commentary and loan grading by Clayton underwriters and QCers on that loan.
Excuse me just a minute. When you say that they would receive it, let's say Deutsche Bank was the bank you were working with. Who would, where would it go? Is it somebody in New York that would get it, or how?
It could be on a typical diligence. If a client had someone on site, they would get it. But there was typically someone in their their home office, if it was New York or wherever,
right,
it was, that was the transaction manager that would get it. Yes.
Is that typically Joseph Schwartz?
Yes.
Okay.
For Deutsche Bank.
So he'd get a report every day on whatever loan reviews you were doing for him?
Yes. Now, I'm speaking from the clients I worked with, but I do think that Deutsche Bank was one that probably got reports every day. They would specify. I mean, I can't think of a client that waited till the end of a project to get their first set of reports.
Got it.
But so the typical was that we would start, you know, day one, at least by day two, they would see our progress and start to get reports.
I'm going to show you what I'm going to mark as Exhibit 2, which I'll represent to you, is a list of documents Deutsche Bank says they typically received from Clayton in connection with due diligence. Can you look at that and tell me if those are adequate, or are you aware that there are any reports not mentioned in there?
Okay, let me look.
And just go down the list and tell us what each of them is,
okay,
please.
Okay, that'll be good. Because these are the ones that I was going to continue to tell you, so this is good.
Well, I'm a little bit ahead of you.
Okay, good. Credit Event 2's report, it says list mortgage loans Clayton coded as 2. And that is a report that,
The check mark to the right of it is mine, by the way.
Okay, okay. Clients did typically get that. Sometimes they would get their event ones and twos together, some of the clients. But in this case, it looks like Deutsche specifically wanted their credit event twos broken out. So that's typical.
And a two, again, was one with a minor defect or one that would have been a three, but because of compensating factors, was determined to be a 2?
Yes, correct.
Now, who makes that determination about the strength of the compensating factors to overcome a rejection and make it into a 2?
Okay, we oftentimes we've discussed that with our clients, so we know the things they like as compensating factors. In our system, we have what we call standard compensating factors so that we don't allow things like 1 year on a job. We typically want to look for 5 years on the job as a compensating factor. So we have standard factors in our system, but the underwriter chooses them, and then when the loan is QC'd, then the QC'er looks at them and determines the strength of it, and then oftentimes they're reviewed also by our project lead, because again, we can run reports that segregate and bucket things so that a lead could run this Credit Event 2's report and go down and look at every loan, not only that was graded an Event 2, but we would show the exception and then the compensating factors and then also some of the loan characteristics of that loan.
But ultimately, who made the decision about the validity or the strength of the compensating factors that it was sufficient to overcome any defect that occurred in that loan application?
Well, ultimately, it would have been our client because they got all of our reports and they could give us feedback on anything, not just if loans were event 3, but they got these lists of whether they were 2s or 1s.
But presumably, the preferred leads like Calvin Peterson, having been done so many deals with Deutsche, was aware of these compensating factors.
Yes,
and he knew those which would be acceptable to Deutsche Bank.
Yes.
Notwithstanding that, did he have to submit that to Deutsche Bank for some affirmative action?
It was submitted to Deutsche Bank. I'm not sure about the affirmative action, but Deutsche Bank would review all the reports we gave them, and as I said, they would often give us feedback.
Well, suppose there was a 2 that was on the borderline, possibly a 3.
Mm-hmm.
How was it that it was determined, and what document evidences the fact that this has become a 2? We like this because of these compensating factors, and we pass on it. And who was responsible for generating that type of a report?
Ultimately, it would have been the lead that was responsible for generating the report. But then it also, as I mentioned, it goes back up to the client service manager,
mm-hmm.
who reviews it. In Deutsche Bank's case, they had a specific client service manager. She could then get feedback back to the project lead and say, you know what, I don't think Deutsche would be comfortable with that loan, or maybe we should run that by Joe. And, I mean, I know that he got all the reports, too, so ultimately he could have made any decision.
Is it a case that something gets classified a 2, and that's sort of a red flag for Deutsche Bank to look at?
Yes.
Okay, and it's also a red flag in terms of, as I understand the process, the bankers would make a deal on the pool of loans. The sample would be taken, you guys would do your work, and then they would close the deal based on the price that was agreed to, the work you did, and whether or not there should be an adjustment in the price. Does that sound familiar? Or is that on the other side of the wall?
Yeah, that's on the other side that I didn't see. I just do know that our work always went back to them, and they, you know, I'm not sure exactly what they did with it, but I know in many cases of me working with clients, I would get feedback from the clients. And yes, you had a good point. Twos are red flags, and especially if you see them in certain areas. Maybe it's assets. Maybe they didn't verify the complete amount of assets needed to close. Well, if you saw that on one loan in a pool, that might be that you would, you know, look at the compensating factors. I'm speaking as a lead to in the way I manage my deals. It's not just looking at it on the loan level and saying that, well, this loan needed $5,000 cash to close and they only verified three, so I'm missing two. But I have really good compensating factors. I'll make it a two. As a project lead, if I ran my reports, my event two, and I saw that out of 100 loans we were looking at, we had maybe 40 event twos on the credit side for asset verification, and I saw that they were never verifying all the assets that were needed, I would talk to the client. I would say, you know, on its own, each of these loans may have compensating factors that offset the fact.
But this
that
is a trend you need to be looking at.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
So Clayton's purpose was basically to separate loans into these are definitely okay, these are definitely not okay, and these are in between, and we're raising that for you to consider.
Yes.
Whose decision was it to take the in between for you to consider, and how was the decision evidenced when it either moved up to the one level or down to the three level? How was that memorialized?
We have exception tracking in our class system, and we have more than 1, 2, and 3 grades.
You have a 2C grade and a 2W grade.
And a 2W grade, and we have 3C and 3D and 2W. So the 1, again, is just there were no issues that we found or noted. A 2 is that we noted minor exceptions that were offset by compensating factors, or a minor exception. And then a 3 was the Clayton grade, where we found material exceptions or material missing documentation. Then we would give those, or and a 3D is the missing documentation. Okay, 3C was it was curable, as in the case of an underdisclosed finance charge, you might be able to reopen rescission and refund the underdisclosure and then cure the loan if a client wanted to go that route. But what would happen, and I think we're getting to the question you're asking about here with the twos, a 3, an initial 3 or 3D or 3C by Clayton's system and Clayton going through the underwriting and the QC process, and it goes to our client, and if the client chose to make that loan a 2, we didn't just make it a 2, we made it a 2W.
Indicating that the decision to accept that loan was that of the client.
Yes.
And the W presumably stands for waiver.
Waive. They waived our 3
grade. What was a 2C?
There wasn't a 2C. We had a 2T.
There wasn't a 2C for Clayton?
No.
Okay. But, so the memorialization of the decision to accept a 3 loan and have it rendered or have it considered a 2 was the fact that it was entered in as a 2W.
Yes. Yes. And looking at this set of reports, because I didn't work on Deutsche, the event 2s could have been just the straight event 2s, or it could have included the 2Ws. I'm not sure of that.
Would they have been different reports, separate reports?
That's what I think. They could have been different, or this report could have included them, but it would have shown one as a 2 and one loan as a 2W, so they could have both been in there.
But on a daily basis, Deutsche Bank is given a file or a report consisting of 2s for which it presumably will make a decision, yes or no. And if it says yes, then it comes back and that 2 is converted into a 2W.
No, that's where they would get the 3s.
Oh, okay.
So it would have gone from a 3C or 3D up to a 2, or to
gotcha.
A 2W.
Thanks.
Which report contains 3s? If you find a 3 as you're going through the deal, which report would identify those?
This looks like it would be the open issues report, which Deutsche calls things a little different. Because it says it lists exceptions identified by Clayton during diligence review for credit.
And again, for the record, you are referring to a document entitled, it was given us by Deutsche Bank, saying typical documents received from Clayton during credit review. Is that correct?
Yes. And then there's one other one. And that is exhibit, it shows on this report list as exhibit four. Well, no, because this says final reject list, so that could be, we don't know where they get their final reject list. So maybe that is all the loans that are remaining is 3, 3C, and 3D. I would have to look at the reports to really be able to tell you.
Is it the case that a loan could migrate from a 3 on a daily report up to a 2W before the final report is done because of some work that gets done, or because you talk to the banker and the banker says, oh, that one's okay?
Yes, the different transaction managers with different clients had different ways of looking at them. So it could be an ongoing process during the review,
right,
or it could be wait till the end of the review, I'll take a look at all of them and get back to you.
And really still all that we have here is a report from you to the banker to aid the banker in his decision as to which loans to buy and which loans not to buy.
To the transaction manager, not the banker.
The what?
When we say banker, we're not talking investment banker. We're talking transaction manager. That's who we provide our reports to.
That is the representative of the client.
Yes.
The representative.
Joe Schwartz.
Yes.
We think of him as a transaction.
Okay, well, I call him
the bank. Nomenclature. I mean, just so long as we're thinking of it.
But fair enough. The whole process here is about giving the transaction manager more information about the pool so he can decide which ones he wants to buy and which ones he doesn't.
That's my, yes.
And you don't really know which, at the end of the day, which ones he buys and which one he doesn't.
No.
We can go through that with them. But we don't know which one he buys, and we don't know who he's talking to internally at the bank if there are other people involved in that decision-making process.
Right.
Well, let's take about a five. We're going to take a number of breaks during the day.
Whatever you guys want. We
can roll that. Mine is nicotine-proof. I'll tell you that. We'll go off the record. What time is it, John?
It's 10:55 a.m.
We'll come back on the record as soon as we return. Thank you, Chair, who has presented to the State of Connecticut and the Attorneys General. And I just want to go over some of that with you, if I may.
Okay. We're back on the record.
We are back on the record. What time is it, please?
It's 11:04.
And you had mentioned a 2C before. I think you might have been referring to the 3C when you said 2C.
You may very well be correct, and I must have misheard something in my prior interviews, but I understand a 2C is, in point of fact, a 3C.
Yes, and that's
there is
curable.
No 2C.
If it's helpful for you, I can point you to the exceptional tracking manual we provided to you in the production, which lays out each of the grades in there.
That would be very helpful.
Yeah, that's page Clay 279 of the production.
And again, the title of that document?
That's the exceptional tracking manual.
I think it is, yeah.
Exception tracking users guide.
Exception tracking users.
User guide. User simple. Which starts at Clay 283.
Okay. What I have shown you a copy of, and want to hold this right here, but I want to show you a copy of what I'm going to mark now as Exhibit 3 to your statement, and ask if you can identify that report. You don't have to specifically identify the particular report, but
it's
the type of report. It's entitled Individual Asset Summary Report.
Yes.
This appears to be one done for Merrill Lynch, Mortgage Capital.
Yes.
Sierra Pacific 2005-108.
Yes.
And was prepared by Clayton on 12/30/05.
Yes.
What is this report?
This is a report that was run that gives the credit and compliance event grades. I'm looking. This is not one a report that I used on any of my clients specifically, and I'm not sure. It says IAS on credit or compliance event 1, 2, 5, and 9. So I'm not sure what the 5 and 9 are on there. It looks like...
Well, you're certainly more likely
yes,
to know than I.
Yes, I know. I know. I'm not sure how that got on there. That doesn't look like anything familiar. But it looks like one that was run on the credit or compliance event 1s and 2 loans.
You'll notice in there, I think, that each name or loan and loan number is supported by a 2 or a 3-page document that's also contained in this file.
Yes.
For example, if you look 3 pages back, you'll see there's a Guy Christian, and the pages 1 through 3 of the attached document appear to apply to Mr. Christian.
Yes.
Or Mr. Guy. Yeah.
So the top 2 pages are the table of contents, that show what page the individual asset summary for each of the loans. So you've got the loan number to the left, the borrower's name, the credit event, the compliance event, the loan balance, and then the page numbers for their corresponding individual asset summaries.
If there were a For example, on this the front first page of Exhibit Number 3, a compliance event of 2, what would that indicate? I notice that there are no such indications on this document.
A compliance event of 2 is an evidentiary issue, is the way we use the term evidentiary. It's something that's not a material risk to either any federal, state, local, high-cost, or anti-predatory violations or regulations, so it doesn't violate any of those. It's more of a just an evidentiary issue, as we mentioned before, that people should maybe look. A lot of it is around pre-disclosures and the fact that we may not see the initial good faith estimate or, where the escrow form, whether in the file. So it's more about pre-disclosures is typically when you'll get a 2 on compliance.
Is it fair, and I'm going to try to put it in a lawyer language and maybe your lawyers can interpret this for you, is it fair to say that a ranking of number 1 on compliance is prima facie evidence of having complied with state and federal requirements with respect to the loan in terms of the HOPPA and the other type, truth in lending and whatever.
Yes, that we didn't find any violations.
Okay. Now, can we flip over to the 3 pages right behind that one, the one that has Mr. Christian Guy's date on it? And I just want to make certain I get it. I understand what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
The loan information here says origination date. That indicates, let's just go from the top, and you just tell me what each of those entries relates to.
Okay.
What does it mean?
The origination date would be the date of the loan. The first payment date would be the first payment that's due on the loan. The original note balance is the loan amount that we got from the note. The original note rate is the initial rate on the note. The original P&I is the original principal and interest payment that we get from the note.
Mm-hmm.
The stated maturity date is the date that the loan will mature per the note. And then the term is, in this case, 360 months. And our system does some calculations on these kind of fields, mm-hmm. so that if we put in the start date and the maturity date, it will calculate that term so that our underwriters don't actually put that in. The amort type is the amortization type. In this case, it's a fixed rate mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
If it were an adjustable rate, that would be in there. Is it a balloon with a question mark? In this case, this loan is not a balloon.
Uh-huh.
And that's another field that our system calculates, and then our underwriters see it as a flag. If it is a balloon, they say, is it a balloon by note design, or, you know, is there a miscalculation? So our system's doing a lot of calculation.
Okay.
As our underwriters are putting data into the system. The remaining term, you can see, is a calculated field. So it takes the date, where we are today, and then tells you what your remaining term would be, or at the time we reviewed the loan. The current balance, you can see that we've got some fields that show calculated, CALC, and then you've got some fields that show tape. In other words, we wouldn't have
Yes.
Yes. We wouldn't have in the loan file the actual current balance or current rate, but we get that information off the tape. In other words, if you were looking at a seasoned loan that maybe had had rate changes or things like that, we'd be able to give that information back to the client from the tape.
What do you mean by seasoned loan?
A loan that's older than current production. In other words, some of the loans we looked at had...
This wasn't done last week. There's a loan out here for 2 years.
Yes, exactly.
Would that indicate to you, as is actually indicated, if you come down the loan application?
Yes.
The purpose is an equity cash out?
Yes.
So this was an additional loan on top of a previously awarded loan?
No, this is a refinance. So it was their primary occupancy is the next thing. Well, we had a few more things in the top.
Sure, but go ahead.
Prepayment penalty and then who the originator was. So this is all data on an individual loan that we're getting back to our client as a snapshot of this loan, okay, out of our system. And then you go down and you've got data, we qualify it as, or, you know, quantify it as the loan application type data. So it's the occupancy, in this case it's the borrower's primary occupancy. The purpose of this loan was an equity cash out. So it was a refinance, it wasn't a rate term. We make that distinction. We tell you, we don't just say it's a refinance. We tell you whether it's a rate term refinance or they took equity out.
Can you just clarify what a rate term refinance is?
A rate term refinance is when you refinance, you don't take any cash out of the property. You don't increase the balance you owe. Mm-hmm. You're getting a lower rate or a better term. You may be going from an ARM to a fixed. And possible, or you know, and that's a, you know, key thing. The total cash out in this case is $107,994. So the note balance was $150, and they took cash out. Cash in hand to borrower, that's a field that shows, did the borrower just get cash? Did they pay off debt with the loan?
So in this case, the difference between $107,000 and $150,000 was what? Is that what's indicated there? Is that what you infer, that the difference between $107,000 and $149,000 on the current balance was used for some other purpose, the original note balance?
They would have probably paid off another loan with that $43,000 or some kind of debt. We may even show.
Now, if I look over here to the title, it says lien position, best case, and it has a 2. Does that mean that this is a second mortgage?
Yes, this is a second mortgage, yes.
And if I look immediately above it, it says the original appraised value is $1.1 million. And then right next to it, it's original LTV /CLTV. What does that tell you?
That tells me that that's the original loan-to-value and the combined loan-to-value. And in this case, because we're doing a second, that's why they're both showing, really, it's the CLTV in this case because it is a second. But if you look over to the right of that, you'll see the subject LTV and CLTV. Mm-hmm. You'll see the 12.61 and the 80.55. So you're actually seeing that you're seeing the subject loan to value, but then the combined loan to value there,
which includes the first.
So including the first puts it up to the 80.55. If you just look at the second, it's 12.61 for that loan only.
Got it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. If you look down here, this in where it says lender doc type, and I'm looking right down here. And it indicates that it's a stated income from application.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back up to the left there, it says that the borrower, number one, is an executive sales, self-employed, and has, if you go all the way to the right, you see BW1 monthly income of $25,000. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, $25,085.
Can we go over to the next page, please? I'm looking down at the non-material exceptions. Compliance. These are obviously, presumably, what they say they are. They're exceptions to this loan which were not deemed by the underwriting team to be material. Is that correct?
That's correct. I would like to say that for compliance, we do review all compliance grading with our clients and find out how they want to grade compliance on some things like the missing good faith estimate, the FACTA, the fair and accurate credit disclosures, how they want to grade them.
All right, so this is a good testament that with respect to compliance, at least on this issue, that if this loan were approved and for purposes of obtaining a compliance grade of 1, that it was an affirmative act by the client that denominated this as acceptable.
Yes.
It says here, what is missing good faith estimate in that section?
That is the fact that we didn't find the good faith estimate in the loan file when we reviewed it.
Does this indicate then that the client will have waived that failure or that absence of a document, said, I'm not really concerned about that?
Well, they didn't waive it, but on their compliance profile at the time, the deals, we set up the deals, in this case for Merrill Lynch, they told us, and we would work with their compliance attorneys, typically with our transaction management team at, say, Merrill Lynch, and they would go through the compliance profile document and note how they wanted to grade the compliance exceptions.
Okay. Can you go over to page 4? And this is the Nicole Rosma loan.
Yes.
I'm looking over here at the appraisal information. It says original LTV 100%, CLTV 100%, lender subject LTV 20%, I'm going to the right,
yes.
And then 100%. Does this indicate to you that it's a piggyback loan? It's a first and a second?
Yes.
You do that by the fact that it's 20% to 100%.
Yes, and that this is the second that we're looking at.
Okay. Flip over to page 5. And you see compensating factors, qualifying score at the very bottom, qualifying score of 1 of 740 versus minimum of 620 required for stated doc loan application. That's a good fact.
Yes.
Mitigating in favor of doing this loan.
Yes.
Again, we're missing a good faith estimate here.
And
in the non-material exceptions on page 5 for the Nicole Rosma.
Yeah, there were.
You'll find it. You're going through this report, this series report, that is a common notation.
Yes, and then there was also the non-material credit exceptions for the cash reserves less than required.
Okay.
Yeah.
Again, this non-material compliance exception would have been vetted or approved by the client. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what about the credit, non-material exception with respect to the credit, the cash reserves less than required? Would that have also required the affirmative approval of the client?
Typically, we talked to clients as we started to work with them to get their feel for compensating factors, but this is the case that I mentioned to you earlier where this looks like it was an underwriter decision based on the compensating factors that the borrower, it wasn't that they didn't verify any or have any cash reserves. They had 6 months less than the requirement. The guidelines required 3 months. The borrower had 2.4 months, and then we had the compensating factors shown above to offset that 6 months that weren't. Sure.
But if you'll go back to the original, the first page, but hold your place there,
yeah.
You will see where Nicole Rosma had a credit event 2 here, so her qualification was 2. Is it because of this credit problem?
Yes.
This compliance issue that was done?
Because of the credit issue.
All right.
And then the compensating
factors. Credit issue is exactly,
yes.
I misspoke, and I'm sorry,
okay.
I apologize for that. All right, let's go down to... I'm back to the first page, and you'll see your first 2W report is a Melissa Variza. I'm sure I've got that wrong. But.
Okay.
And This is a 2W. And the indication on the credit event is that but for the affirmative approval of the client, this would have been ranked a 3. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Can we flip over to page 13, the upper right-hand side of that? By the way, I have seen in some places here a general waiver. What is a general waiver or a is that the right term, John? What was it? I think it's a general waiver or broad waiver.
Bulk.
Bulk waiver. Okay. Waiver in bulk is okay. My yes, absolutely. What does that mean?
A waiver in bulk would have been where a client would take one exception and then tell us that they were going to do, and we called it that, a bulk waiver, go in and make anything that had a 3 for that exception and make it a 2W.
Is this done at the outset? I mean, is this done as a part of their overlay?
No.
This is done as a result of the actual inquiry, and then we see a number of these occurring, so we waive it in bulk?
Yes.
Which means that it, but for the fact that it was, but for that waiver, it would have been rejected?
It would have been a 3, 3C, or 3D for that exception. And with exception tracking, grades are associated to each exception, and then the overall grade goes to the loan. And of course, you can't have any loan with an exception of a 3. That's the grade it's going to get. You're going to get the worst grade. But you could have multiple exceptions, and you know you might have 2 exceptions on a specific loan, and maybe 1 on the other. And so, if a client chooses to do a bulk waiver, that exception will get waived on both of those loans. One loan may remain a 3 because it may have another exception that was a 3, 3C, or 3D, while the other loan may become a 2W because it, you know, so it takes the waiver of all the exceptions. So that's why we would do these bulk waivers.
I want you to look at page 65 here. And you see page 65, and it relates to Jose Jacques de Sargent. I think that's, let's see, where is he?
Yes.
Yes. He appears on the first page as a 2W. But on this page, it says compliance waived in bulk per client on 12/30/05. And I'm talking about the non HOEPA loan, APR exceeds mm-hmm. HOEPA threshold, waived.
Mm-hmm.
So this would have been a 3 but for the fact of this waived in bulk.
Yes.
So every person within this loan file that had met that difficulty in connection with the analysis of the loan would have been waived in. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And I say waived in, it may not be the right term.
No, that's good.
Okay. How common was it to have, in your experience, how common was it to have waived in bulk in these reports?
You know, it varied by clients. And the clients I worked with, I know I had one that typically would wait till the end of the deal, review all the loans, and then give us a whole list, and mm-hmm. either by exception or by loans with many exceptions tell us to waive. Some clients never gave us that feedback. In other words, we would give them their final reports, and what they did, and our system would never reflect any change, possibly, in anything they did.
So how does this work, especially with the exceptions, when you were saying the client decide what's material exceptions and what's non-material? Do you give them like a prior draft of this report, or is it just kind of a phone call, hey, here's the 5 exceptions we found on this loan, how do you want to handle it?
In this case, they would get the reports. Yes, they would get a report. And then this, when you start seeing the 2Ws, that means they've seen a report prior to this report, because Clayton wouldn't put a 2W on a loan.
Okay.
But in order for them to be advised about the condition that led to the award of, I mean, of the waiver, they have some preliminary report that they get?
Yes.
And what is that report called?
It would look some, it could be this report. It's an exception detail report is another one, which is an Excel spreadsheet, whereas this is in a PDF. They can get an Excel spreadsheet. Different clients had different, you know, they like the way they could, some like to slice and dice their reports and wanted them in Excel. Others wanted to sit and mark on these forms and read the story and give us the feedback. So there were various reports they could get.
What was the turnaround time? I mean, this is a, albeit not a huge document, but I can imagine this is only 44 loans. I mean, what happens when you've got 500 loans?
It just takes a little bit longer to produce it, you know, through the system. But it's most of our reports for our, you know, clients that we were doing, you know, repeat deals, we had their standard reports set up in our class system. And okay. When we went into, we have a reporting tool called WinFish, and we can go in and we have a button that our client service managers or our leads can push the button and run the standard reports. And so they just take the data, generate the reports.
But over time, that would have changed, wouldn't it? How are you
yes.
apprised of the changes?
Yes. Exception tracking keeps up with everything from the underwriter's original grade, how they grade the loan, through the QC changes, through any STIP clearing. So in other words, if we get trailing and missing documents in, all that's kept in the system, retained in the system. And then the client, when they review that loan and give us feedback, if they change the grade, that's retained. So we have a history of all the grades in our system with exception tracking, and then we can run reports on that. But what you typically see is you just see the most updated data. So if I run a set of reports this morning and I'm the lead and I'm running a deal, and by this afternoon my underwriters have now underwritten 50 more loans, I've been furnished missing documents from the seller, so I've made changes, and possibly my client got reports from yesterday and looked at them and gave me feedback, then tonight when I get all that data in the system, so the system houses all that, it's not kept like in a, you know, a notepad or anyone's head, it's all in our system. And then when I run reports tonight, it's going to incorporate any changes and updates, and it's going to show you how it looks right now. I can go in and look at that history, but I don't always have that history printed out on the form.
Exception tracking reports, are they listed here on this document?
All of our reports involve exception tracking. So exception tracking is the system we use. It's a, in other words, we implemented the systemic ability to track exceptions from the inception by the underwriter through the QC, through the whole progression.
Let's say you opened up the file day one and there was no note in it. That would drop right to three, right?
I would put missing in for my note. It would shut down some fields. It would allow me to input some fields that I could get from other documents. But immediately, if everything else was okay on that loan would be a three for credit and for compliance because of the missing
right.
note. It would be a 3D.
Right.
Because it would show, if that was the only exception on there and everything else was okay, it would be a 3D.
Right. Okay, so let's assume that that's the case. On day two, the seller finds the note and it shows up in the file. Does it then go to a 2, a 2W, or does the thing go jump right to a 1 automatically?
Okay. If I get the note and everything is fine with it, it can go to a 1. If
yeah,
I input
okay.
the data, that loan can go to a 1 because then everything's okay.
Okay.
So our history would show that it was a 3D by the underwriter, a 3D by the QCer, and now it's a 1 because I got a missing document. The thing with missing documents is they can also create exceptions so that maybe I'm, you know, my prepayment penalty when I get my note is a little off or, you know, and it, that creates an exception. So then it could go to a 3. It could create another exception, and we have
got
all
it.
That trail.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. We're spending a lot of time differentiating between 2s and 2Ws. But fundamentally, isn't the difference between a 2W and a 2 is that the 2 might otherwise have been a 3, but because you know the transaction manager, the kind of loans they'll accept, It just automatically becomes it becomes a two as opposed to dropping to a three and making them every time turn a three into a 2W.
Not really, because in my underwriting experience, and as a lead in a CSM, a two is a less material exception. In other words, if I had a loan that had a 4% loan to value exception, I would be comfortable if I had good compensating factors. My borrower had been on their job 25 years. They had owned the home 22 years. They were doing a rate term refinance, and they had a good credit score that met or probably exceeded the guidelines. That would be a two. If I had a loan that was an LTV exception of 8 or 10, me and my role with Clayton, I would make that loan a three. Even if I had the compensating factors, the same compensating factors, I would then make that loan a three, because that loan presented risk to me. It was way outside the guidelines.
Got it.
And that's the kind that would then go to the client, and the client may say, I'm okay with that. I see the compensating factors you still had. I see that the LTV exception was 8 or 10, whatever, but I'm okay with it. That would become a 2W.
Okay. So,
go ahead.
So a 2 is sort of an exception, but no big deal.
Yeah.
To become a 2W, you either have to be a bulk waiver or an individual waiver.
Of a three.
And it's something that is a bigger deal.
Yes, a material violation of the guidelines or risk, yes.
Now, when you say a two is no big deal, what are you basing that on?
Well, I won't say it's not a big deal. It's just if you have a debt to income, let's say your debt to income ratio requirement for this loan is 45,
mm-hmm.
and my borrower's at 46, and I have compensating factors, I would feel comfortable saying that if I felt like overall the borrower could repay the loan, he had the ability and the willingness, everything in the file looked like that, and he was 1% over on his debt to income, I would feel comfortable making that a 2 and showing that to the client that I made that a 2 with these compensating factors. The client could come back and say, you know, Vicki, I'm not comfortable with that. I want to make that a 3. They always had that ability to go both ways. But if the borrower's debt-to-income ratio was 10% over, if it was 55, no amount of compensating factors, me as a lead or an underwriter, I would make that loan a 3. I would want to put that back to the client for any decision.
To summarize, a 2W is the affirmative act of the client to waive a 3.
Yes.
A 2 might involve a judgment call on the part of the underwriter, the QC person, the lead, or the lead in connection with a representative. We don't know where that occurred, but all we know that it was, for the most part, not necessarily material.
That's correct.
Now, is that affected? And what I'm trying to get at is that tolerances, that little wiggle room that you get in there, is that set beforehand, or is part of the overlays? Or is that something you just know by having dealt with that person for many, many transactions over years?
It can be any of those. Yes.
Or is it something that you actually have the judgment? You have the judgment to make that to make it a two as a. It's a judgment call by Clayton as opposed to something.
Yes, it can be. Yeah, and it can be that too. We do have clients that say, you know, basically, you know, they don't give us as much direction, while some clients did give us very specific direction.
It's been very helpful, and thank you so much for this. But what I'd like to get into now is, were there differences or distinctions in the types of services provided in connection with the due diligence procedures we've been talking about? And due diligence for warehouse lenders, due diligence for mortgage insurance companies, due diligence for issuers, due diligence for underwriters. Were there distinctions between the scope or the review process for each of those types of? I'm presuming you did those, right?
Yes, I did some of. I don't know that I ever did any with PMI companies. I know we, you know, Clayton may have done some, did some, I'm sure, but I didn't do any for my clients with the PMI companies, the MI companies. But the biggest, the difference is when we knew what we were doing the review for, they didn't always tell us. You know, they may not say this is a warehouse line review or we're the underwriter and, you know, on this deal. You may or you may not. Our scopes were typically the same. They involved, you know, getting the tape, setting up the system, cracking the loan file, using whatever guidelines they gave us, you know, whether it was just the originator or the originator plus any overlays, and then furnishing results back to our clients. Really and truly, even, I tried to kind of think about that, the difference in the warehouse lines. As a project lead, I understood the difference was that at the time it was on a warehouse line review. Like if I was going out to New Century for Lehman and running a project and it was a warehouse line review, I knew that it was, they weren't going to be like someone wasn't going to buy this loan at the time. I got that. That it was more of a QC type, more of a quality control, so that Lehman would know, you know, what loans, what the quality. They wanted to look at the quality was the way their transaction manager that explained it to me wanted to have, you know, just a hands-on review of loans so that if they wanted to sell those loans or get those loans off the warehouse line, what was the quality of the loans? So that was the purpose, as I understood it, for our role in looking at the warehouse line loans. But we typically didn't, I mean, on the ones I didn't do anything any different. In other words, I used their same script or system that I used for Lehman. We used the same exceptions. You know, we gave them the same reports. It was the same process. We went through the, here are loans that are missing documents. Can you get them to us? And then we gave them all our findings.
Well, let's suppose, for example, that I'm, say, Deutsche Bank, and I've been offered to bid on a pool of loans. And I'm going to take those, I'm going to buy those loans, and I'm going to own them, and then I'm going to push them out. Mm-hmm. Was there a, versus, I'm Deutsche Bank, I'm an underwriter, and he's a pool of loans that's been presented to me by Countrywide or somebody else. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in the methodologies employed with respect to those two type reviews?
I can tell you, because I did talk to the client service manager for Deutsche Bank during some of the work we did.
We know.
You know. Okay. And so I do know that there was a difference there because they didn't use all the overlays that Deutsche Bank typically used on, you know, their reviews where they were just buying loans.
That's right.
Yes.
Was, for example, did you notice that the percentage of the loans pool changed? It was 30% when they were buying and 5% when I was doing it for Countrywide?
Yeah, you know, I didn't notice that. Because I didn't work on the Deutsche account, so I didn't notice that.
But generally, would you say that it's true that there was a distinction between the two types of reviews?
I'm trying to think, and I do believe that when I did the Lehman and was involved with Lehman, I think the warehouse line reviews may have been a smaller sample.
Okay. But with respect to Countrywide asking me to do them and me buying them over here to own myself, uh-huh. Were there similar differences in the scope or nature of the reviews?
As I understood it from Kathy talking about the Deutsche.
Kathy is who?
Kathy Ireland, I'm sorry, the client service manager that was on the Deutsche account. I do think that there was a difference in, I guess you would call it kind of their scope, or the overlay of guidelines, because maybe Deutsche Bank wouldn't want to impose their, you know, thresholds and things that they were doing on maybe the others. I'm not sure what their thinking was.
How were those overlays or differences in guidelines communicated to Clayton?
They would come through the transaction manager at our client to our client service manager.
So somebody at Deutsche Bank sent them to your lead?
Well, they would send them to our client service manager, okay. And then the client service manager would then get them to the project lead.
Got it. Mm-hmm. It's not the only time I'm going to
No, that's okay.
get your nomenclature ball and
no,
stuff.
It's fine. And I know I'm bad about thinking that everybody knows all the words I use. So.
Are you aware of differences and distinctions in selecting the samples of loan pools to be reviewed? I mean, was it, I want you to get all the outliers, or I want to do a random sample, or I want to do some other type of sample?
Yeah, typically the deals I worked on and most of the deals I know, we were not involved in the sampling. Our clients would pick the sample and then send us the tape. We didn't even always get the full pool tape. We would just get the sample that they had selected.
So all you didn't know what was in the balance of the pool. All you knew was in the sample.
Yes.
And you're not aware of how that sample size was agreed on? Or you didn't even know what the size of that sample was. It could have been 100% of the pool, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
We used the example of Deutsche Bank, but were there, let's take Lehman. Would Lehman have different overlays for underwritten deals versus bought deals?
You know, I didn't work, when I was working with Lehman at the time, I was client service manager for them, they weren't the underwriter for deals. They were mostly going out and buying.
Okay.
Loans.
Okay. Who else did both, do you remember?
And this is just strictly my memory. Yeah. I think I Deutsche, because I talked to Kathy about it. I think Bank of America did, because I remember working on a deal at Option One once with Bank of America, mm-hmm. and kind of started to understand that the role of the, you know, the underwriter and the, you know, how they were working. So I think Bank of America, and then I think Greenwich.
Greenwich.
Mm-hmm. And there could be more, but those are the ones that I can think of.
No, that's fine. That's helpful.
Tell me typically what happens when a client is informed of or notices or is in receipt of a significant amount of exceptions within a loan pool. What do they do? And what is it indicative of?
What is the client's reaction
to
us?
When you send it along to them and say, hey, here it is, you got all these exceptions.
Yeah.
So.
We start to look for, are they, and that's one reason our exception tracking is so helpful. We can say you've got this big percentage, like if you've got a 30% reject rate, what percentage are made up of just missing documents? What can we try to, you know, what could possibly come in? And, you know, as those trailing docs and conditions and SIFs that we show are missing come in, then we can start to process those. Or they can look at the roll-up categories. Our exception tracking rolls up exceptions into categories. So first they can look at our reports and, you know, working with clients, I'm familiar with how they would look at them. You know, just working with them on it, they would say, you know, what's the credit event and what's the compliance event? So is it a 3 for credit and a 1 for compliance? So they'd start to look at them like that. And then, like I say, with the missing docs. And then the exceptions themselves would roll up into categories, and they could say, you know, they could look at them and say, oh, I've got all these applications issues or this. Now, what they did was individual to client, you know, each client. And, you know, once we got past anything we could get that were missing documents, then everything else was their decision if we had graded the three.
Well, I mean, for example, if you come to me with a number of exceptions, then I'm going to say, whoa, wait a minute, maybe I better be looking at more in this pool.
Oh, okay, I see where you're going. So early on, we would give them a report, maybe day 2, let's say, and they start to see a lot of loans. They could, I know I worked on a few deals in you know, the past where they would stop looking at loans.
And you say, hey, we pass, we're done.
Yeah, they would just stop the deal. That's one thing they might do. Again, it might be, you know, how many of these are missing docs that we can get in, you know, and they look at the reason for the exceptions. And then other times, I'm not real sure what they did.
Well, maybe they could go back and say, we're not going to pay you as much for that loan as you want.
It could have been. It could have been.
But are you familiar with generally how they reacted in connection with a significant number of exception reports received by you as to what their likely action would have been?
No.
Okay. I want to really kind of drill down, if we can, into the exception tracking reports. I'd like to know a little bit more about it. I mean, you've used it a lot, and I've got a general idea of what it is, but tell me, what the heck is it? What is it?
Okay. Exception tracking, we developed that, I think, around 2005. Mark, I get my dates mixed up, and you always remember that.
When it got rolled out.
Yeah, when we rolled it out in 2005, first 2006. And we developed exception tracking for many reasons. One was to be able to show our clients, we thought it was a good product, a good way to show our clients the makeup of their exceptions. In other words, before exception tracking, we only had 1, 2, 3 grading. And then we went to the 1, 2, 3, 3C, and 3D. So it started to break out loans for missing documents, you know, exceptions for missing
documents. So you're getting a more detailed report.
Yes, it's a very, it's just a lot more granular snapshot into what's going on these loans. So it wasn't just a 3 anymore. It was the reason. And then by scope, so we have our credit scope and our compliance scope. For the credit scope, we had like 20-something exception categories. You had things from assets, appraisals, credit history, insurance, you know, value not supported. You were able to take individual exceptions because you could have various exceptions about, say, the property. Maybe my loan was a 3 because the property wasn't acceptable, but it could have been because it wasn't acceptable to the guidelines. It could have been the property condition. So we wanted a way to roll up individual exceptions into a category to start to show clients and to show our leads. They might want to look at things, you know, exception tracking was very useful in the QC process. So it was both for our clients so that they could see this almost like a management view of what they had and what the exceptions were. And then it was for Clayton also, because before exception tracking, I would manually select an exception as an underwriter, and then I would have these comments, and I would go in and just type comments in. And what we did is we started to standardize exceptions so that we had things like under LTV, we might have LTV 10% or greater, LTV 5% or less, LTV exception between 5 and 10%. We could start to trigger automatic exceptions so that made us more efficient and our quality improved, because when you have a manual process and you have underwriters looking at so many documents and going through so much information, it might be easy to pick an exception and forget to put a comment in, or type my comment that I have an LTV exception but I forgot to select my exceptions. So we tied the exceptions and the commentary together, and we began to, as we do in our compliance system, have more of a rules-based approach to exceptions, but they were automatic. And so exception tracking was, and then I mentioned the piece of being able to also follow as part of underwriter performance. How did an underwriter grade a loan? Was it changed during QC? Did the lead have to change it? So we got all those benefits out of exception tracking.
You met with Joe Swartz and Michael Comitato in summer of 2007, didn't you?
Yes.
And did you take the exception tracking reports with you? What type of reports did you take with you?
We took our trending reports.
Trending reports. What was the purpose of that visit at Deutsche Bank?
The trending report visit, we were showing them a new product that we were in the process of working on. It was a work in progress. It was generation one of the trending reports. What we were trying to do, Clayton, we knew we had a lot of data on loans and on grades of loans and waivers of loans, with the exception tracking, what were the categories of the exceptions. And we were trying to come up with what we call trending reports to take, for instance, for Deutsche, quarter over quarter for a period of time, take their top 5 sellers and start to show them where were the exceptions, were they compliance exceptions, credit exceptions, how did the loans grade out, were they 1, 2, 2W3, 3C, 3D. So we were trying to put together some reporting like that. So analytics, I guess you would say. We had management wanted a little more analytics out of us.
Who was with you on that meeting?
I will try to remember. There was, I believe, Kathy Ireland was there, Paul Marques, one of our clients, one of our business development, Derek Green, who worked on the exception tracking, trending reports.
How was that report received? Not well, was it?
Not well.
No. It was not received well. Why? What was your impression as to why it was not well received?
We were in the meeting with the transaction management team, and we were going through it, and they were understanding and listening. I think it was not well received when Michael Camerato, he's higher level management, and he came in and we showed it to him. It was not well received because, and I'll just kind of quote him, in the hands of the wrong people, it could be misunderstood.
And he was in charge of securitization, and we know now why he believes that, but that's another issue that we'll talk about at another point.
Who did you understand Mr. Camerato to be referring to when he said the wrong people?
I didn't know. I don't know.
How did you interpret his comment?
I interpreted his comment that he understood the depth that his transaction management team made, had, as we've mentioned, these credit these overlays to guidelines. Deutsche Bank really looked at things very conservatively. We, you know, graded a lot of loans during our review for Deutsche Bank as threes per their instructions.
Mm-hmm. And those appeared as two W's.
Yes, and then they appeared as two W's, which you know may have the connotation that clients were waiving threes.
Sure.
Yes.
The connotation would be, we're trying to get this stuff out the door. We're not holding it on our books. We're pushing it out. We'll take anything and
exactly.
do it. That is probably what he was defensive about.
That would be how I would think.
But Mrs. Beal, the information that you had showed to the representatives of Deutsche Bank in this trending report, you had no reason to believe that the information was incorrect in any way, correct?
No, we didn't think the information was incorrect. We didn't think it was incorrect.
So the reports that you were showing to the Deutsche Bank people, you believe were accurate?
Yes.
How far back did their trending reports, so you had to show a trend, how far back did they go?
We had, I think, 4 quarters, I believe, for Deutsche Bank that they had been on, they had to have been on exception tracking.
And this was a program at Clayton that could do this?
Yes, it was a database. And
so presumably if I asked you to run the same program for Merrill, you could do it, right?
I'd have to look and see because we did some clients and I'm not sure. Was Merrill one of them?
The production you should have that was given to New York, that was also given to other attorney generals, the trending reports that were given to all the top 15 clients, if they were given them at all, are in that production.
All right, we have those trending reports.
Yeah, I can look up now and see if
there's okay.
Can find out where they are.
Yeah,
because we didn't do them for all clients, and to do them was like a process of getting their deals, identifying them. We had to normalize data into a database, so it was a process. So I would be just off the cuff. I'm not sure we could do it, that right.
When you say 4 quarters, though, it would have only gone from the middle of or the early 2006 to early 2007?
I think that was about right. It could have been toward the end of 2005. It depended on when they went on exception tracking.
Okay. Did most of your clients, were they on exception tracking?
Yes, most of them were.
And that base section starts at Clay 134603.
134603?
Right, and that starts with the Bear Stearns one.
Thank you.
What institutions are represented in the trend reports that you're referencing?
Mark.
Well, let's see. Is it going to be?
Yeah, maybe it's easier. For
Goldman.
Just look on my computer. I'll show you.
Right, okay. What's the list?
Bear. All right, Ryan.
Seabass.
Sorry.
Seabass. Countrywide. Credit Suisse. Deutsche. Goldman. Greenwich. HSBC. JP Morgan. Lehman. Merrill. Morgan, Nomura, UBS, and WAMU.
All the usual suspects.
Sounds like a pretty exhaustive list.
For some of them, no reports were given to them, so you'll see when you go into the production it says no reports in the file. But we went back and looked to see if any were given to all of those clients, and the ones that were are all in the file. So you asked about Merrill?
Yes.
To the extent, Mark, that a report wasn't given to a client...
Merrill's in there.
To the extent a report was not given to a client on that list, is it possible to generate such a report from the databases that you have?
I would have to... Yes, it would be possible.
We may be asking you to produce that or to generate that report.
And Ms. Beale,
actually, I feel fairly comfortable that we will be asking you to do that.
I'll make things easier. I am asking you to do that, reports, please. Ms. Beale, what work did you do for Countrywide? I noticed Countrywide is on that list, and I just want to understand the relationship with Clayton and Countrywide. Generally, what type of work were you doing for Countrywide?
Generally, we were doing the same kind of work we did for all of our clients. We would review loans. And I wasn't the Countrywide client service manager, but I do know they had several groups at Countrywide that looked at, maybe some looked at their prime and all day, and then some subprime. And so we, in that, I know we worked with different transaction managers within Countrywide, and but it was basically the same kind of review.
And how long did that relationship last between Countrywide and Clayton?
You know, we did work for Countrywide when I was working for Clayton on the road. We were doing some deals for Countrywide, but there was a period of time that we didn't do as much work for Countrywide. They used other vendors.
Now, I understand Countrywide originates mortgages and also has a securitization shell, so they're unique in that sense compared to some of your other clients. So were you interacting with Countrywide on mortgages that then they were purchasing from third-party mortgage brokers? Was that the relationship as opposed to their own originated mortgages?
You know, I will tell you, and again, this is all just my recollection,
sure,
and I didn't work on that account, but I know we actually went out and, you know, would be out in Calabasas and have teams looking at loans out there. I think those could have been some Countrywide originated loans, but I'm not positive of that. But then I also know we went out to Ames and Option One and places like that for Countrywide also and looked at loans that they were purchasing.
Did you, for example, when you were engaged by Deutsche Bank as a client, did you have occasion to be reviewing Countrywide loans that you were aware of? Where they were underwriter of those particular shelves or loans?
I would have to look back at the deals and see to be sure of that.
How many meetings did you have with folks like Mr. Camerato and Joe Schwartz with firms other than Deutsche Bank?
You mean with regarding the trending reports?
Yes, regarding the trending reports.
We have a list of them. I didn't attend all of them. I think I was involved in maybe two or three in-person meetings and one phone call with Goldman. And in some cases, we had meetings with people at a higher level, and then we would have meetings with more the transaction management level people. So I think that's all in the...
Did you ever receive a warmer reception than the one received at Deutsche Bank?
Yes, we did. We did.
And where was that?
The Goldman phone call. They were very excited about it, about the view into, you know, looking quarter over quarter. I know I didn't participate in the Lehman call, but I know, you know, from having worked with Lehman mm-hmm. before this, because I was in a different role at the time. I wasn't a client service manager when we rolled out the trending reports, but I know Lehman liked it. They liked that. They like to see quarter over quarter how were the exceptions at the originators they were doing business with, where were the areas that they might want to look at, were compliance exceptions on the rise, had they brought them down, you know, that kind of thing. So, yes, I think there were clients that had a warm reception.
Did you also show trending reports or other related type reports to any of the rating agencies?
I think we had, this is all from memory.
Surely.
We had a meeting with Moody's. They came to Shelton, and I don't remember exactly when that was, maybe 2007, early 2007, mid-2007. And I think we showed them like a mock-up kind of
a mock-up, precisely what? Of what?
Of trending reports.
And the trending reports related, I mean, not necessarily, were they related to deals that they had previously reviewed? Or this just generic,
just,
without...
Almost like dummy data, like just to show the concept.
This is what we're seeing in the industry, generally. Is that right?
No, it didn't have any... I think it was more just to show them the concept of what we were trying to do, to show clients. It didn't have, like, real data.
Okay, this was a sales presentation.
Not really sales.
Who attended that meeting from Moody's?
Oh, goodness. This is, again, strictly from my memory. I think it was Warren Kornfeld might have been there. He was, and I think there might have been a couple of either like their
David
directors
Keister?
Or yes, that might have been a name. There were a couple of like directors or managing directors, and then some of their analysts, and I couldn't recall their names.
Gus Harris?
That doesn't ring a bell.
Linda Huber?
That sounds familiar.
Ray McDaniel?
I can't remember. I really can't remember. I know there were some analysts, and then a couple of like director people that had asked us to show them our process.
Who from Clayton attended those meetings?
Let's see. I know I was in part of it. It was a lengthy meeting.
Mr. Marchese again, because he's kind of his job is what? He's the marketing guy?
He's a business development.
Okay.
And he worked with worked with a lot of the rating agencies.
Sure.
I believe Carrie O'Neill. I'm trying to think.
What was Ms. O'Neill's job?
Carrie was executive vice president over transaction management and platform services.
And tell me what that means to a person who doesn't have a clue as to what your business is. Okay.
She was over all the due diligence and operations.
Ah, now you got it.
Okay.
That I understand.
I just could remember her title. She was I reported to her.
She was in charge of due diligence.
Due diligence, and operations.
We'll presumably be talking to her down the road, I guess. Any other meetings with any other clients that you had similar to this? I mean, to discuss the tracking reports.
The trending reports.
You were well received some places, and
yes,
you were definitely not well received at others.
Yeah, yeah.
Where were you not well received other than Deutsche Bank?
You know, that's the only one that I recall.
Did well at Lehman?
Yes, from what I didn't attend the Lehman, but the feedback was that
Bear was still around then. So.
Yes, and they gave us, in fact, Bear, because at this time I wasn't a client service manager. I was working in the product development team, kind of putting together the trending reports and creating them and developing them. So we got feedback, and Bear had a lot of feedback for us of, you know, what they would, you know, things that would be helpful to them, that kind of thing. So I would assume by that it was good feedback from them, good reaction.
These reports took place at a time when it was generally perceived that underwriting standards were not trending upward, they were trending downward. Is that what these reports show? That there were more exceptions the closer you got to current time?
You know, I'd have to look at them. I haven't looked at them in a long time, but, I mean, it just showed... It showed the top five sellers, their top five sellers over time, and I mean, you could look at the individual ones, and I'm sure you could get a picture, but I don't have.
It would depend upon seller and maybe the buyer and lots of other things.
Yes.
So you just have to look at the report.
Yes.
Okay. Mickey, these reports show all the, say with respect to a particular client, the trending report, did it show the client's, say, four-quarter reject and waiver rates?
Yes.
And that report had a summary page by quarter that listed total loans reviewed,
Yes.
Grade threes awarded and grade two W's in percentage weighed.
Yes.
How large were those percentages from time to time? Were they ever as large as 40%?
You know, again, not having looked at the reports in a long time, I really would have to look at them to see. I think there were some that were higher, you know, than others, but I don't remember the exact numbers.
Well, we'll presumably we'll look at those
okay.
and be able to determine. And if we don't, we may ask you back.
Okay.
We might. What is Clayton doing now?
With trending reports?
No.
Okay.
I mean, well,
look, it's an open-ended question.
2007, 2006, you were hip deep, and I mean, 2006, you were hip deep in doing due diligence. Now, there's not darn many of those going around right now.
Yeah.
What are you doing now?
We do. We've got other business units, you know, our surveillance and staffing. We do some staffing solutions. But in transaction management, you know, we're still doing some reviews for clients. We're doing some post-close QC-type reviews.
And these kind of like fraud reports for, hey, my warranties and representation said you wouldn't do this, but we want to hire Clayton to find out in those instances where they did, in fact, do that so that they'll have to buy the loans back.
Yeah, our
putbacks, we call them.
Putbacks, yeah. Our Clayton Fixed Income in Denver handles the putbacks, so they're not in our transaction management
okay.
area, but they do, they do some of those. And we're doing, you know, some people are out purchasing non-performing pools of loans. So we look at more of the seasoned non-performing. So we're looking at that. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been engaged by the government to go in and look at stuff? Like FDIC, are you drilling down on CDOs and that type of thing? That
Steve might be better at that.
Yes, we have a number of government contracts with the FDIC, but not looking at CDOs. Mostly looking at assets in banks that they have taken down, and they're looking to set up a bid process, for example.
Gotcha.
And we'll do due diligence on both commercial loans and residential loans.
Good. I'm going to ask you some. Do you know a fellow named Burkeen, Gary Burkeen? Well, do you know these leads? I'm really interested in something. Gary Barmore and
Gary
I.
Gary Barmore.
He and I are going to cross swords for it's all over. He's got a large following out there.
Yeah, I probably do know most of those leads.
Deb Medina?
Yes.
Calvin Peterson?
Yes.
Now, are these people still being employed from time to time by Clayton?
You know, some of them are. I'm not sure if you've got... You know, who you've got on the list, but we have some are in our Tampa facility. Some people actually relocated and live in Tampa or work from Tampa.
Gary moved from Texas there?
No, he didn't.
He never leave Texas.
I did see him in Tampa a month, 6 weeks ago. He came and did a deal for us.
Tell me when you transitioned from general on-site visits or to the hotels in and around California, wherever they were, to your Tampa facility?
We were talking about that earlier with Brad. I think it was about 5.5 years ago we opened the Tampa facility. And before that, we had started to do what we called centralized underwriting out of our Shelton office. If clients would ship the files to
mm-hmm.
us, or, you know, some of the sellers had gotten into imaging and they could get us a CD, or we could go on, but some of them have websites
mm-hmm.
that we can get, you know, passwords and access and go onto the websites. So we had really started it probably in late 2003, started a small operation in Shelton, but we really opened Tampa probably a little over 5 years ago.
How much of your business was done off-site? And by that I mean in a non-owned or titled Clayton facility. I'm trying to get a feel for how you recruited your people and brought them and sent them across the country.
Okay. Well, in the beginning, you know, when I started with Clayton and went through, you know, being out in California a lot, as you mentioned, or on the East Coast, wherever we had to go, it was like 100%
yeah.
of the loans were done in the field. I mean, every deal. I can't remember going like to a Shelton office and doing a deal. I would go to the site.
Okay, one thing that just may be relevant to your knowledge, which is one of the things that clients are very sensitive about not the clients, I'm sorry, the originators were very sensitive about at one point in time, which they became less sensitive about as technology evolved, was the security of the information they were giving over to Clayton, which is one of the reasons why the business started by having you go on site. They would never let the loan files go off site.
Makes sense, yes.
So sure. Over time, as technology evolved and data transfers became easier, it was easier to start migrating to a centralized facility.
And they did have certain laws that were applicable to them about security and whatever.
Correct. And some could not get comfortable with it, which is why you still had a hybrid mix of services being provided.
I'm going to show you what I'm going to mark as Exhibit 4. It's a series of documents. Again, this was produced in connection with, I believe, the Connecticut AG or one of the AGs, and ask you, I believe it's something that was prepared by a fellow named David Johnson, or David Keith Johnson.
David Keith
Johnson, yes. Are you familiar with that? Were you part of this briefing?
Yes.
So you ran, you started off with 2006 kind of rough, but things ended up getting pretty better, or much better throughout the year?
I'm trying to think of 2006. I mean, that's what he says there.
Yeah, are you familiar with that? I mean, you were there, well, Clayton.
Yeah, I was at Clayton, and he may have, I work so much in transaction management, but I know, we have other business units, so...
What were your peak years in terms of the production of the due diligence material at Clayton? What do you think were the best years y'all had?
I would think, I would say probably getting into 2004, mainly 2005, and the first part of 2006, maybe. It says right first quarter. So, but 2005, I know we were very busy.
I have neglected one area of questioning, and I'm going to hold questions on this and go back to it. I want to talk about compensation of underwriters, QC, and leads.
Okay.
How were underwriters compensated at Clayton?
Underwriters were paid an hourly wage, and then per diem if they were working off-site, working.
If you moved to California, you would do what? You'd pay their hotel room,
mm-hmm.
pay
yep.
their travel?
Travel,
you get, and
car,
you get them food.
And a per diem.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And your QC people, presumably because they were cut above, they had more experience, they received more hourly?
I would say their wage would be, commensurate with their experience and their tenure.
And your leads, again, because they had more experience, they were paid more.
Yes. And I know when I was a lead, they had started, you got your lead salary, but if you didn't lead that week, you didn't get lead salary. So if you just went back to being a QC or an underwriter, you got your wage, but you might get a bump in pay if you were a lead. That's how it was at one time.
Were there bonuses set up for timely completion of projects?
I was not involved at the time in the lead bonus, but the way I remembered it, it was based on overall quality, and there was a lot of feedback from the client service managers who would get feedback from the clients. And so I think it was all a part of, how they performed on the job.
Well, I mean, I'm looking here where Barmore is number one. We want him as a preferred lead, and some other people say, hell no, I don't want him. So it apparently cuts across. What has to do with their interpersonal relationships?
Is a lot of it, yes.
Ms. Beal, did you ever remove a Clayton employee from an arrangement or a review because you had received a complaint from a client?
I didn't work in that area ever of staffing. I don't recall.
If I'm Gary Barmore or Deb Medina, I get a phone call saying, you better get out to California, we want you to lead on this project. And how would I go about locking up underwriters? Or would I, or would that Clayton do it?
Oh, Clayton does that. Yeah, that's what I say. I didn't work in that department, but we have a whole logistics team. We had people that managed all of our laptops. We had people that we have a database of all the underwriters, where they live, their salaries, their availability. They furnish us their availability. And then whether they're underwriters, QCers, or leads. And we have people that in this database pull and staff based on, you know, location, so that if you live in California, it's more likely you're probably going to do California deals than fly to New Jersey and work at CIT, you know, that kind of thing. So we had a whole department that did that, that monitored performance of the underwriters, got feedback, worked the leads, and they did all that. They did the staffing.
Whose employee, I mean, if I'm an underwriter, and I'm working a Clayton job site, or the one for which you have contracted with the client, at which you due diligence is to be performed. Uh-huh. Whose employee am I?
We have, and Steve can probably speak to this even better than I, but we have a company called PCI that is a personnel coordinators, and they're actually employees, right, or they're paid through.
So PCI is a PEO.
You have to speak English.
I'm sorry.
You have to speak Southern. You have to speak Southern to me. Tell me what the hell that means.
So a professional employee in organization.
Okay, gotcha.
And really why it's set up this way is this is an ADP and Paychex, which I'm sure you've heard of. They have units that are set up as PEOs, as separate corporations. And they employ similarly situated employees. So employees that are doing different things, doing relatively the same things in job classification categories, so that they can obtain for them favorable unemployment insurance ratings, workers' compensation ratings, and also benefits can be made available to that group should you select to do that. Clayton made a decision, I don't know exactly when this was, in the early 2000s, to convert, I believe that Clayton had for years employed its underwriters as 1099s. Somewhere in that early 2000s time frame, Clayton decided to move to a PEO. There are all kinds of issues around, I don't need to go into the details with you, legal issues around 1099s who keep working on the same type of work for some period of time. And the government has a real concern about that because they don't get the company to be paying the Social Security, and a lot of contractors somehow mysteriously disappears when they're supposed to be paying it.
Yeah.
So Clayton moved to a model with this PEO, the company named PCI. PCI is technically the employer of the individuals who are doing the underwriting and the leads and the QC. PCI has absolutely no role in the management of these people in handling their day-to-day activities. It's straight
ministerial,
ministerial function. Those employees are the responsibility of Clayton from a client perspective. In other words, in our contracts with our clients, we are responsible for their performance, for their for their performance.
If a client were to accuse Clayton of negligently performing a due diligence, who would they come looking to serve?
Clayton.
And PCI?
They could. We have an identification of PCI in our agreement, so they are 100% covered. I mean, to the extent Clayton survives, they will be covered by Clayton. It's a very broad and non-conditional indemnification.
The PCI, was this arrangement, and I'm going to ask the witness question, you and I can talk later.
Sure.
Sorry, my bad.
They existed before Clayton, is my understanding, and they still exist in many other clients other than Clayton.
Transaction management review numbers, are you familiar with them at all? At Clayton? Do you have any idea what the basis for that representation is there?
Well, it looks like it's our field, which are the people that were going out to the sites reviewing the loans.
Right.
So that would be the field underwriting teams. Centralized underwriting would be the Tampa facility. And the conduit was, we had a conduit business unit that managed a conduit for several of our large clients. So this
tell me what that means.
The conduit was I didn't manage it, so I'll tell you what
Whatever you understand. We'll ultimately get somebody to explain it to us, but you tell me.
Okay, I will tell you what I know. It was specifically, you worked with the clients that we had a conduit set up for, and we had those set up for the ones that come to my mind are UBS, Nomura, Morgan Stanley. And I think we started one with WAMU. I think we had a WAMU conduit. And you worked with them specifically. They had very specific scripts. They weren't our standard class, our system. They were built specifically. And they were more
built specifically
for the client.
But did the underwriting requirements change? Did the concept of the underwriting change?
They were a little different in that the structure, the setup, we were really the back office for our client to have a conduit of loans coming through from sellers that they had, they were getting loans from. And we would review the loans either, there were two ways, as I remember it, loan by loan, so that there were just loans coming in, or they could run some what they called mini bulks, so they weren't the big purchases of loans they were going out and getting. They wanted to run them through the conduit as mini bulks, but I don't have all the details and the difference.
Whenever you did a due diligence, you did it based on guidelines and overlays.
Yes.
What is the basis of the due diligence here?
It is the same thing. The difference is that these sellers would lock a rate in with our clients, and we would then start to work with those sellers. They were typically smaller sellers. And we had a transaction manager.
Smaller loan originators.
Yes, smaller loan originators. And our team, our conduit transaction management team, rather than having lots of people go out and look at loans, you would have a loan come through. So you had the underwriters that were looking at the loan. You still had the QCers. But instead of a real lead, you had more of a transaction manager that then worked. And there was a lot of, hand-holding to get documents in, make sure the loans were complete, because you wanted those loan files to be complete. You wanted to work through any issues. And then they also, what I remember of that also, there was a lot of servicing and boarding information was built into the script that we didn't have in our transaction management side, and so that the loans could then go and be serviced and boarded.
Boarded means what? You're not putting them up in a hotel.
What does it mean?
Yeah,
well, they're boarding them. They're moving them from the originator to the servicer. Right. So they're going to board the files so the servicer can service them. So you needed to have updated balances. You needed to have updated escrow balances, that kind of thing. And they had to be to the day because you wanted to be sure that they got handed off so that they could start the servicing.
That's a very fine explanation.
Is that good?
That helps me.
Was the difference that the loans in these conduits system were really to be for servicing purposes, and then the loans that Clayton used the class system and their typical due diligence were loans that were going to be securitized?
They were going to be purchased. Now, whether they were going to be held as whole loans or put into security, we didn't always know, and the purpose didn't change for us there.
Was there a distinction in the type of loan originator who was pushing loans towards the conduit? I mean, whereas one end you had Countrywide and these massive loan originators, and here you got mom and pop, is that it?
Yes, they were less, not as well capitalized, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe they didn't have any other, this was their outlet for their loans.
And mom and pop were flabbergasted, right?
Possibly smaller, yeah.
I'm sure.
And another differentiator also was there was a lot of up front in the conduit process, you had valuations being ordered. There was more done around third-party services, around occupancy, kind of fraud checks, that type thing. So there was more of that being incorporated into that process.
Who was the conduit transaction manager?
Scott Mowry.
Mowry?
Mowry.
And he's still at Clayton?
Yes.
See Scott every day, do you?
I report to him now.
Tell him he's next. We'll be talking to Scott. All right. So, loan volumes, does that pretty much comport with your understanding from your work at Clayton from 2000 through?
Yes. Yes, it kind of shows it really going up in 2004. Like I mentioned, I was trying to get my time frame right, and then,
Did there come a point in time while you were at Clayton that you came to understand or have the feeling that there were some loan originators who just weren't as good as others? And who were they?
You know, I've thought about that. I mean, I didn't, while I was working on deals, I didn't really think of it that way. I mean, there may have been, you know, people that it was a little bit harder to get files, you know, to keep the file flow going, that kind of thing. But I guess if I, you know, in thinking about it, and this also comes from just my personal experience, okay, you know, and just my opinion, I would say that the ones that were a little bit more difficult maybe or were like Fremont, Long Beach, AmeriQuest, Encore. Those were some of the ones that I can think of.
Any others? Who were the good ones? Who were the ones that you enjoyed working with? Who you thought were doing it, or at least trying to do it in a professional way?
Wells Fargo was, I would say, would be at the top of that list for me in the people I worked with. I think there was, yeah.
On a routine basis, how many folks did you deal with? Just about all of them? Or?
Our clients?
Mm-hmm.
When I was as a project lead, mm-hmm. I worked with most of our clients at the time.
When it comes to this loan volume here, who was taking the majority of that volume? What were the clients representing, the folks who are asking you to perform due diligence the most? Do you have any idea?
Well, you know, year by year, I really can't tell you. I do know that there were some, I remember a couple of years that it was Deutsche and Lehman were probably, you know, our top two. I think that would have been right in some of these periods. I'd have to look and see.
We produce all that information.
Surveillance. What is surveillance and how does it work?
I can't tell you everything about how it works because I don't work with it. But what I think and what I've, you know, been in presentations and seen is that's our Denver. It was the former Murray Hill that Clayton was merged with, and now it's our Clayton Fixed Income. And they get monthly. They get written into the deals, the securitizations by the trust. And monthly they get servicer remittances, and they run data through very sophisticated you know, databases, and they find things like when prepayment penalties aren't being properly adhered to. They find MI claims that aren't timely. They do things with
MI claims.
Mortgage insurance claims. Okay. So they take data and they add value back by making sure that the trust, the securitization, is getting everything they can out of the servicer. They're surveilling the servicer on the, yes.
Okay.
Is that a thing?
So
that's what I know.
And you have no idea.
I don't.
This is, y'all have been growing pretty well, but I want to get to this one. It looks like the due diligence was certainly the significant portion of the revenue generated by Clayton, at least in 2005 and 2006. Would you agree with that? Is that your experience there at Clayton?
Yes.
All right. You were with Clayton when it was a private company?
Yes.
You were with Clayton after it became a public company?
Yes.
And you were with Clayton when it became a private company again?
Yes.
Tell me how that transitioned. What happened in terms of your experience there at Clayton?
In terms of my experience, when it was a private company, you know, we had with Steve Lamondo, the founder of Clayton, you know, I kind of went through some of it. The company grew. Steve and his management team were good, I felt, at seeing kind of what was going to go on in the industry, so that we changed. I mean, like I said, we looked at RTC loans to begin with, mm-hmm. and then a lot of, you know, I know from, you know, hearing things on the road that there were many due diligence firms at that time. But
there were many of them?
There were many. Back in the RTC days, okay. A lot of people looking at loans, you know, helping people look at loans, look at what they bought. And I felt like being with Clayton and my experience with Clayton was that the management team was good at diversifying, you know, seeing if something ended, what could they do next? And, you know, we got in, as I mentioned, we did things for bank mergers and, you know, we did a lot of things. Like I did a long-term job at Conti for Greenwich when they were, you know, going into bankruptcy and they were their warehouse line. And, you know, I saw that. And then when we became, you know, a public company, it was interesting because we started to pick up more business units. You know, like we didn't, when we were private, we had, you know, the conduit and due diligence, but we didn't have, you know, the surveillance and the things we picked up when we went mm-hmm. public, it seemed like, you know, or maybe we had it right before then. But things, you know, sort of more diversification into more business units sure. is what I saw. That would be the biggest thing I saw. And then there was management change, and, you know, you know, it was just, you know, different than what I had worked with before. Not better or worse, just different. You know, it was just a different culture. And then I will tell you that since we've gone back private again and we have new leadership again, I'm, you know, very excited about the leadership we have with Paul Bossidy and coming from GE. And he's got a strong Six Sigma background and very much about, you know, quality, and that's a big thing to him. And his management team that he's put in place is very strong, and that's been...
I have neglected yet one more area to talk about, and I don't have a whole lot more areas to go over, I will tell you that, but competition. You spoke a little bit about it in 1993 when you started and said there were lots of competition.
Yeah.
How did that change over time, and who were your chief competitors in this area?
Well, in 1993, I don't even know all the companies, but sure. I know I kind of got in with Clayton and mostly stayed with Clayton and did do a short time with GE, who at that time had their own like due diligence company, and then I did a long-term job at GE, and then when I went back with Clayton, I was with Clayton forever then.
Were you doing due diligence at GE?
You know what I did at GE? I was doing, it was when the RESPA with the HUD-1 and the way you had to disclose HUD-1s, mm-hmm. and there had been some, you know, I guess it didn't work with all their correspondence and all didn't do it right. So we sent out a lot of like corrections to the HUD-1 and then were there to take phone calls and any feedback or questions on the clients. So I did that. But otherwise, the work I did with Clayton was all due diligence related. But the companies that I saw, you know, as more of our competition were Bohan. You know, as we got into the time frame when we were really doing a lot of, you know, a lot of diligence, it would have been Bohan, AMC, Opus, 406 Partners.
406 Partners.
Uh-huh. MDMC, Watterson Prime. Watterson.
W-A-T-E-R.
W-A-T-T-E-R-S-O-N. Prime.
Okay.
Those are the main ones I can think of.
How much of the market share do you think, if you know, Clayton had?
You know, I don't know. I don't know that I ever knew, you know, what our market share was.
Do you have any questions? Mm-hmm. I think we're done with you. And thank you so much.
Yeah.
It's been very helpful. It has indeed. And it's been enjoyable as well.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it. I like to talk about the business.
Well,
stuff.
I mean, you do it well. John, will you take us off the record?
Time is 12:34 p.m.